So I'm going to talk to you about the the Gaulian myth, which is the subject that I've been working on for the last few years, and which still interests me, even though I've published a book on it. There are many aspects of it that I hope to continue to work on. It's one of those subjects that I think one could devote a lifetime to, and one would still not arrive at a comprehensive treatment of it. Let me just start by saying what I mean by myth. I don't mean it in to connect to something Julian was talking about earlier. I don't mean it in the sense that someone like Georges Sorel talked about a myth as a kind of something that enables a form of ideological mobilization. Although there was that aspect of this to de Gaulle and to his action. What I mean is something perhaps a little bit more social scientific. It's simply a myth is a form of collective representation, a collective representation that can either be a form of positive idealization. So when we're talking about the Gaulian myth, we're talking about de Gaulle as he's regarded as a founding father, as he's regarded as a political educator, as he is regarded as a prophet, a sage, a liberator, of course. These are all the ways in which de Gaulle himself and people today in France have talked about him and still do talk about him. But of course, when we talk about representation, we also talk about negative representations. And to connect to what Robert has just been talking about, if you just look at May 68, May 68 is one of the great moments in modern French history when de Gaulle is represented negatively. And if I was as well organized as he has been, I would have brought you some nice images of posters, of May 68 posters, which show de Gaulle in a variety of very unflattering ways. Various slogans, various famous May 68 slogans are anti-de Gaulle slogans. So in terms of these negative representations, we have de Gaulle the traitor, of course. That was the first big negative representation, le général Micro, as Vichy used to call him, the agent of the British, the Soviet agent. There's a kind of interesting but now forgotten literature which represents de Gaulle as a Russian agent, the delusional figure, the man who suffers from delusion of grandeur, the authoritarian leader, of course, the dictator. That's a kind of absolutely common trait, particularly on the left, all the way up to, I would say, the early 1980s. And also the idiot. One of the ways in which de Gaulle is most often lampooned, in fact, is he's represented as someone who's kind of simple d'esprit. Early in the late 1950s, Jean-François Revel brought out a very funny little book called Le Style du Général, which basically took apart de Gaulle as a writer, because one of the things about the 1950s was when de Gaulle's memoirs came out, absolutely everybody said, oh my goodness, what a genius this man is. Nobody has ever written French so beautifully as the general, which was kind of slightly exaggerated. And so so Revel wrote this rather polemical book, which wasn't really a kind of critique of the memoirs so much as a taking particular sentences of de Gaulle in his public speeches and showing that very often they were kind of extremely platitudinal. You know, de Gaulle is very famous for saying things like je vous vois comme je me vois, or nous sommes ici, n'est-ce pas, vous et moi. And then he stops, and everybody, and every kind of everybody thinks, "Wow, what fantastic oratory!" So anyway, negative and positive representations abound in the history of the Gaulian myth. The second opening point, though, is that those days of negative representations are largely over. If we look at France over the last 20 years or so, the most striking thing is that nobody criticizes de Gaulle anymore. I mean, if you look really, really closely, whatever is left of the kind of Vichy, extreme right, ultra-Catholic, tiny, tiny minority of people who can still defend the memory of Pétain. That crowd still attack him. But they're finding it hard even to kind of publish their kind of books and pamphlets at the moment. But apart from them, absolutely everybody says de Gaulle is great, de Gaulle is wonderful. He's become the dominant historical figure in French political culture, celebrated by intellectual elites, political elites, celebrated also, and this is one of the things that I've tried to look at, across the French territory. So one of the interesting things you can do with France is measure how popular historical figures are by looking at the naming of streets and public squares. And if you ask the very basic question, who in France has more public squares and streets named after him, the answer is de Gaulle. He beats everybody now quite comprehensively. Roughly one commune in every 10 has its... It's generally avenue, you know, you wouldn't give a rue to de Gaulle. It's too demeaning. And in certain departments, like in the Nord, you know, the part of France where he comes from, it's more like one in five commune. So de Gaulle is absolutely plébiscité in this sense. The other very interesting measure of de Gaulle's this kind of cult of him today in France is opinion polls. And I've done a lot of work looking at how the French people view de Gaulle. And there's a very clear pattern that emerges over the last 25 years. The particular moments, particularly 1990, which was the celebration of his centenary, the centenary of his birth, when he emerged as this all-embracing figure, celebrated by all political groups, including at the time voters of the Communist Party and the National Front. So absolutely everybody says he is our favorite historical figure. And the most interesting thing I found here was just looking at an opinion poll that came out in November 2010. As you know, we've just had, Julian mentioned it, a kind of de Gaulle year in 2010, because it was the 70th anniversary of the Appel du 18 Juin, but also the 40th anniversary of his death. Is that right? Yeah, 40th. And so for the 40th anniversary, there was an opinion poll again, yet another one. The most interesting thing about that poll was not that it said we all love de Gaulle, because you know his figures there keep kind of increasing. What was most interesting was people were asked this basic question: do you regard de Gaulle as a man of the left, a man of the right, or a man who is above parties? And 56% of the French people regard him now as being someone who is above parties. And that is quite staggering, because when you compare answers to that question, even in 1990, only a small minority of people said de Gaulle is above parties. So in other words, what is happening is a process of consistent mythologization that is taking place. De Gaulle is, and that I think is one of the touchstones of the political myth, de Gaulle is now judged by the criteria which he himself laid down. He said, je suis un homme au-dessus des partis, and a majority of French people now view him in that way. And that is something very, very striking indeed. So you might wonder, well, why write about this phenomenon? And how does one go about understanding it and explaining it? What I tried to do, as I say, it's quite a complex operation. What I tried to do is to understand the phenomenon of the Gaullist myth, to understand it almost as a process that requires social and political explanation. So what I try to do in the book is to construct a series of frameworks for understanding the myth as a kind of scientific object, And what I'm also interested in is the comparative dimension, because if you look at France from the French Revolution onwards, you see that at particular moments in French history, in the 19th century and in the 20th century, there have been significant historical figures who have appealed to the French political imagination. And of course, the great comparison one can make there is with Napoleon. And one of the things that I found most interesting in thinking about the Gaulian myth is thinking about the echoes that there are between the Napoleonic legend and the Gaulian myth. I'll come back to it in the presentation. But one of the things that I found, and which I didn't know at all, in fact, was how taken de Gaulle himself was by Napoleon, how much of Napoleon he had read, how much of Napoleon's trajectory de Gaulle identified with, and how much de Gaulle simply remained fascinated until the very end of his life with Napoleon's legacy. In the Archives Nationales, I found in one of the cartons on the commemoration of the bicentenary of Napoleon's birth, we're talking about 1969, big commemorations were organized by the French state, I found, to my surprise, that de Gaulle had actually asked for those commemorations to include a speech by him, a speech which he never gave, unfortunately, because he lost the referendum in April 69, and he had planned to give a big speech in the Invalides in, he said, September or October 1969. We'll never know what he will say. It's one of those great questions that we can ponder. But one of the things that is very striking is that de Gaulle had this fascination throughout his life with the Napoleonic epic. And this is one of the things that I try and think about. The other thing to just say in terms of how and why one writes a book like this is the source material is absolutely wonderful. Prodigious. I found a lot of interesting things in the archives. The one thing that I found most interesting and most useful were just letters that ordinary French men and women wrote to de Gaulle. De Gaulle was a great letter writer. I think I've calculated that he probably wrote in the sense of actually properly crafted and signed. I'm not talking about kind of form letters. He wrote about 35,000 letters in his life. But he also received them. He received a staggering amount of letters, particularly when he was president, on average about 100,000 letters a year. And in the early 60s, and in particular crisis moments, you had absolutely exceptional volume of letters. During the Semaine des Barricades, for example, during the Algerian War, he received 22,000 letters in 1 week. When he resigned in 69, over a 10-day period, the Élysée received 45,000 letters. I didn't read all of them, unfortunately. But there is a part of the Élysée service whose job it is to read these letters, to produce reports about them, to pass a few on to the police, because de Gaulle didn't always get friendly letters either. But this provided a very important source of popular representations of de Gaulle, because you found a lot of very diverse, fascinating things which tell you how individuals in France identified with him and how they represented him in a variety of ways. Now, I'll give you just a quick sense of how I constructed the book. I mean, if you have more detailed questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them. What I try and do is develop an approach which is both chronological and thematic. So I start with the resistance, of course, which are the years when the de Gaulle legend is actually founded. This is when de Gaulle deliberately constructs himself as a legendary figure, as a mythical figure. And in fact, he says at the end of one of the volumes of the war memoirs, when he's talking about the year 1944, I think that's how the first volume ends, j'étais devenu un personnage quelque peu fabuleux, which is a very nice, typically Gaullian way of slightly understated way of viewing himself. So the myth is actually created during those years, the resistance years. The second moment is, of course, the publication of the war memoirs in the 1950s. Napoleonic parallel there. I mean, the war memoirs are like the Mémorial de Sainte-Hélène, because when de Gaulle writes the war memoirs, certainly when he writes the first volume, he has no real inkling that he will ever return to office. And indeed, it is part of the Gaullian myth that de Gaulle knew all along that he would come back to power in 1958 and create a new republic. But believe you me, when he was writing in the early 1950s, the first volume, he thought it was all over. And when you read the memoirs of his associates, people who are around him in the early 1950s, you see very clearly that he, you know, he's very bitter. He says, c'est fini, la France est finie. Of course, if France is no longer interested in him, la France est finie. That's one of the typical ways de Gaulle saw things. But the second phase is very important because it creates a textual basis for the legend, and I think a textual basis is always very important. The third chapter that I look at explores one particular political ritual that de Gaulle more or less invents, which is the ceremony of the Mont-Valérien, which takes place every 18th of June. It starts in 1945, pretty much, although de Gaulle used to commemorate his own Appel du 18 juin even during the war. I mean, he always makes sure. I mean, he's very conscious of the symbolic importance of this date. So already by 1944, if you read his Discours de Guerre, you see that he's already created a myth of the 18 juin. The 18 juin, as you know, in 1940, nobody heard the speech. By 1944, if you read the speech that de Gaulle gives on the 18 juin 44, I think he's still in Algiers, or he's gone to Algiers by then. He pretty much says, ce discours que toute la France a entendu. So, you know, we're in the domain of mythology there. But one of the ways in which de Gaulle constructs a particular kind of heroic myth is by the way in which he commemorates the 18 juin. And I'll say something about that a bit later, but I devote a whole chapter to this ritual and the way in which it takes place according to a very strictly organized pattern, which is absolutely fixed and almost doesn't change from 1946 to 1969. Every year on the 18th of June, de Gaulle commemorates the Appel du 18 juin at the Mont-Valérien. So that's the third chapter. The fourth, I look at the 1960s, where and with each chapter, in a sense, the myth is not only growing but also broadening. In other words, there are different elements, different composantes, as you would say in French, that are being added to the myth. So, in the 1960s, he becomes a sort of father figure. And this is where the letters were particularly interesting. You find a lot of people writing to de Gaulle, asking him for advice. He takes on sometimes very directly takes on the qualities of a father, but he's seen as a kind of paternal figure. And indeed, if one, without doing too much kind of pop psychology, you could see kind of May 68 as a kind of revolt against the father, right? And that's partly how de Gaulle himself sees it. He's very conscious that there's a kind of breakdown in his relationship with the younger generation. But for a majority of French people, he is seen still in the 1960s as this father figure. The chapter following that, I focus on Colombet. Colombet is a name which has become kind of universal because of its association with de Gaulle. And one of the things I discovered was that de Gaulle kind of cultivated Colombet as a myth from the very outset. If you go back to the Fourth Republic, you see that de Gaulle is very, very sensitive to keeping people out. De Gaulle is someone who makes great use of absence and silence. Not speaking or not being in a place is something which is just as important to him as being present and making big speeches. And by and large, de Gaulle is not one to make big, long speeches. He prefers distance. He prefers elevation. He prefers silence. Those are quite often key techniques in his myth making. And with Colombé, you see that very clearly because it's constructed as almost as a kind of refuge. It's a kind of place of internal exile, a haven of tranquility. De Gaulle would often go there in the 1960s, even when he was president. He tried to get there every weekend, for example, partly because he didn't like the Élysée very much. He never kept any personal object there. In his office, there wasn't a single object that he would describe as personal. He never regarded it as his home. Home was Colombé. And what I do in the book is actually try and see how what I think you have to call a cult develops in Colombé after de Gaulle's death, particularly between 1970 and the late 1990s. You have hundreds of thousands of French men and women visiting there in a form of pilgrimage, which the best approximation is Lourdes. It takes those characteristics. It is a quasi-religious form of devotion. And when you look at the photographs and when you talk to people, this is where I did a little bit of oral history as well. When you talk to the Gaullist militants who went there, they went there in that devotional spirit. So the Gaullist myth expands in the 1970s and 80s by acquiring this quasi-religious character. And then finally, in the 1990s and early 2000s, that's when you reach, I think, another level, the final level of the myth. And this is when de Gaulle becomes accepted by all political groups. Until 1981, he had still been a very controversial figure on the left. But with the election of Mitterrand and with the acceptance by the socialists in particular of the Fifth Republic, de Gaulle becomes a kind of a legitimate figure even on the left. And you see that very clearly in the commemoration of 1990, when actually the leading forces for organizing the commemorations, particularly in Paris, are the socialists. Rocard is prime minister at the time, and it's in 1990 that the text of the Appel du 18 juin is put up on the Arc de Triomphe. For example, just to give you one example, but that happens under a socialist government. So that is a very quick sketch of how the myth unfolds over time. It unfolds over a 50-year period. If you have questions about it, happy to answer it. One thing I will say is that it's not as linear as I just made it sound. There are various jagged periods. The resistance is followed by the resignation, of course. The RPF years and the Traversée du Désert are periods where not much happens as far as the myth is concerned. And by and large, the years when he's in the presidency are not years that are particularly conducive to myth-making. On the contrary, I would say there's almost a kind of inverse correlation between the development and the strengthening of the myth and the occupation of political power. The thing that saves de Gaulle, in a sense, is the fact that he's kicked out by the French in 1969 and that he dies this almost perfect death in 1970. You see the myth kind of resurgent in an almost spectacular way. But I think if he died in office, it would have taken a little bit longer for the myth to kick off anyway. So in the 10 minutes or so, is that right, Julian?
Yes, because we started 10 minutes late, so you've got exactly 10 minutes.
Okay, in the 10 more minutes, I want to just draw two or three quick highlights. As I say, if you have specific questions, very happy to try and answer them. But I want to just dwell on two or three things, which some of which I haven't kind of fully worked out myself, and so I'd be very grateful for any thoughts you might have on this. Thank you. One is trying to answer the question, any political myth, and particularly the myth of a general, you would imagine it to be associated with a form of heroism. And of course, de Gaulle is a hero. He sees himself as a hero. But when you start asking the question, what kind of a hero is he? How does he conceive of his heroism? It's really quite complex. For one thing, there isn't really, to my mind at least, a celebration of military heroism in the Gaullian myth. In fact, for my money, when you look at the Gaullian myth, or the Gaullist myth at least, the great military hero is the Maréchal Leclerc. I mean, he's the man who symbolizes the kind of traditional virtues of the combatant. De Gaulle is a military figure, but he's not really a combatant. I mean, he fought very bravely in the First World War. He fought a little bit before the Second World War, but the French didn't really fight that much in the Second World War as an army. They fought in other ways, but the army, the military stuff, the conventional stuff, ends pretty quickly. So de Gaulle isn't a kind of military hero in that sense, and certainly not a military hero in the Napoleonic sense. And when you look at, and that's why I found the kind of material on the Mont-Valérien fascinating, when you look at what de Gaulle or what that ritual celebrates, it's actually much more a celebration of collective heroism, collective sacrifice. And the Mont-Valérien ritual, in a sense, is a celebration of anonymous people who gave their lives to a sacred cause. And here, there's a very interesting tension, because the word humility is not one that you would normally associate with de Gaulle. Yet, it seems to me, when you think of his conception of heroism, there is a real element of humility in it. He doesn't construct himself as a great military hero. And there are a lot of things he says about the 18 Juin, one in a letter in the 1950s, where he says, and I quote from memory, but it's about right, "Le 18 Juin est une affaire où je me regarde comme tous les autres." Very unbombastic. And I think there's something interesting about this, something that, as I say, I haven't really completely worked out for myself. But he is someone who has, who kind of redefines the sort of canon of political heroism. And I think he was also seen as a hero, of course, for his ability to cheat death, you know, countless assassination attempts against him. But again, de Gaulle deals with those sorts of things very often, not by making a kind of great speech saying how wonderful he is, but with humor. He says to Romain Gary at one point, "Je suis dans l'histoire de la littérature l'écrivain sur lequel on a le plus tiré," which I think is a very nice way of putting it. So heroism is one aspect of this which I find interesting. The other is, of course, grandeur. De Gaulle it's a term that he uses very often. He wants to restore French grandeur. And the thing that I think is very important about the Gaullist myth is that it's not only about creating a new role for France, it's also changing the way the French perceive themselves. And I think, and this is where a comparison with the first half of the 20th century is useful. If you try and reconstruct France's self-perception in the first half of the 20th century, what is France for the Third Republic? France is a great European power, and France is a colonial power, right? That's the self-representation of the Third Republic at its apogee. Ask the same question in the 1960, 1970, how do most French see themselves? They don't see themselves at all in either of those ways. They see themselves as a middle-ranking power, which stands up to the great powers sometimes, which tries to cultivate a kind of distinct rayonnement. And that transformation of France's self-image is something that I think one has to credit de Gaulle with. You may think it's a myth, and I think to a certain extent it is. But what interests me is the act of transforming perceptions, and I think few people can dispute that the perception changed, And my argument would be the main person who helped change that perception was de Gaulle. So I think that's a very important part of the myth as well. And thirdly and finally, the thing that strikes me about the Gaullian myth is, like all great political myths, it's very plastic, very adaptable. The Napoleon myth was very much like that. Napoleon can be the emperor or the republican hero. He can be the warrior or the man of peace. I mean, a bit of a stretch, but it was an important part of the Napoleonic myth in the 19th century. He can be the conqueror and the martyr. He can be forceful and vulnerable. De Gaulle is the same. When you look at the ways in which his image is transformed over time, you see some quite staggering transformations. You see someone who was regarded as arrogant, distant, being transformed today by his son, no less, as a loving father, homme de famille. One of the most successful memoirs of the early 2000s was a book called De Gaulle, Mon Père, published by Charles de Gaulle's son, Philippe de Gaulle. And in that, you have a complete reinvention, really, to a very large extent, of who de Gaulle was. The admiral gets lots of history wrong, and so he was kind of taken to task by historians. But what interests me is not so much that, although that's something important. It's that the whole nature of the book is really a kind of enterprise, an attempt to present de Gaulle, to humanize de Gaulle, to turn him into an ideal person, not only as a kind of public person, but also as a perfect private man. And that goes very much to the point I've been making all along, is that in every dimension, de Gaulle is being reinvented constantly as an ideal, as an exemplar. So 1 minute to conclude overall, if I may. What emerges from all of this is, I think, two things. One is that, of course, all countries have their mythical figures. Almost any society requires some kind of great figure. We have Churchill, the Americans have their founding fathers, Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, etc. The thing that strikes me about de Gaulle is how he seems to accumulate a variety of types of heroic figure, because he is all at the same time a national liberator, a founding father, a prophet. You know, he's someone who's celebrated by the Gaullists because he foresaw the shape of things to come. And now he is a sage. Whenever particularly a political group wants to refer to an exemplar of virtue, of either private virtue or public policy, people talk about de Gaulle. So he's celebrated in all those different ways. And that, I think, is the distinctive characteristic of the Gaullian myth when you compare it to other historical myths in other political cultures. Second point, and I'll say it very quickly, and so I'll probably not be very clear, but if you have questions on it, be happy to try and answer them. I think when you compare the Gaullian myth to all the myths that have preceded it in France since the Revolution, the Gaullian myth represents the most accomplished version of the political myth that the French have had. Previous myths have been more interesting, maybe, more sophisticated. They have captivated people in different ways. There's something very rounded, very balanced about the Gaullian myth, which I think qualifies it as one of the most accomplished, as I say, versions of the political myth. And I think what it does very well indeed, and this is perhaps the transition already to what Jean-Pascal is going to be talking about, is that it brings together those two great institutions that the French have been fighting over for so much of the 19th and early 20th century, the Republic and the Monarchy. De Gaulle is the ultimate Republican monarch. Thank you very much.